Accession number 10167, Rule 7.
Mr. Ronald Elliott, Reel 7. You were talking about river crossings, in particular the Volturna we were starting with.
It's really the canal before the Volturna.
Sorry, yes.
The boats tended to be wooden canvas affairs because they had to be portable and transportable by hand. So they were light. But they were somewhat difficult to maneuver where one used them at all, and I don't know that anybody was particularly adept at using them anyway. On this occasion, we got into the boat, and after the usual problems about going round in circles, which one tended to do, it wasn't expected really that there was any activity, because the Germans weren't supposed to be this side of the Volturna, they were supposed to be the other side. We were going up towards the southern bank, I guess, of the river. Anyway, we all got across, and they fanned out ahead of us with the platoons. We were in the company HQ, which was close to the river bank, and we'd taken off the set and put it down and were establishing communications with the base and taken our kit off. And all of a sudden there was this hullabaloo. Grenades were thrown, shots were fired at us, and there was a bit of a panic immediately to our front. And there was a rush immediately where we were back to the river. And either I got into the river or was pushed into the river or something. Some people got into a boat. I found myself in the river and, not being a good swimmer at all, was in some danger of drowning. And I got a hold of the boat, which was floundering around as was its wont. And someone, either deliberately or unconsciously, waved a paddle around and knocked my glasses off. That was one of the things that happened. Whether he was trying to knock me off the boat, I don't know, but I had no intention of being knocked off the boat. I hung on grimly, and eventually we all got to the other side. Meanwhile, pandemonium was still going on to the far bank. There was some defence. Some of the platoons were fighting back, and it clearly wasn't a total retreat, but some small number had retreated, including me. We got to the near side of the canal. I was soaking wet then, without my glasses on, didn't know where to go, didn't know where the Germans were or anything. So there was I, a pretty sorry sight, wandering around in the river bank with the mosquitoes around, not able to see very far without my glasses, waving my Beretta in the air, because that I did have with me, prepared to defend myself, although quite how and in what way wasn't very clear. So that was a bit of a disaster, but by next morning things had quietened down a little. We still had a bridgehead across the canal, it transpired. And we, next morning, we all sort of got back in again.
That sounds like a bit of a panic by a section of the,
yes,
the unit there. Had the other two signallers come back as well?
Yes, but they'd been on the boat or anything. And they'd left the set, which was quite a heinous crime, actually, by our standards.
Was there any comeback about this?
Yes, there was a bit of a hullabaloo about it. and it was regarded as bad form, but I absolved myself of any feelings because I wasn't in charge of the thing at the time. Anyway, it all turned out quite well because what had happened was it was a German raiding party which had landed by boats with the intention of knocking off these engineers who were building this bridge over the canal, which was really quite crucial to the crossing of the Volturno subsequently. So, in fact, we had, although not in a very clever way, had thwarted an attempt by the Germans to knock off this bridge party. And then subsequently, a few days later on, we did cross the Volturno, and we crossed the canal by the RE bridge. And we crossed in boats, and we secured a crossing over on the other side a little bit later on. But before then, it was a wonder that I didn't have malaria because I was out in the cold being bitten by mosquitoes, something badly. But the Lance Corporal, who was in charge, did have malaria, and he packed in, and the other fellow packed in. So I was given two new members and to form a terminal. And this was the terminal that really I had for the greater part of this period of the campaign. And we were, if I may say so, quite a good terminal. We worked very well together. They were somewhat older than I was.
Do you remember their names?
Oh, yes. George Taylor. He was a phlegmatic Lancastrian, been a bricklayer or what have you. Very slow and deliberate in all that he did. Bill Cram had came from this part of the world. He was somewhat mercurial, not wholly reliable, but with the other two, he worked very well. I was in charge of the terminal, and with I had the experience in a sense, but they had the more worldly wide experience, being older than I, so they were able to curb any extravagances of mine. And we worked together really for some months as a very good team indeed, I think. So that was the beginning of what was a terminal which stayed together for the remainder of this particular campaign.
Well, while we're on that, do you remember who your signal officer was during this time?
Yes, they called him Captain Harris.
And
his nickname was Souk, because this had to do with the North African little alleyways. God knows why. We all had, eventually, we all had nicknames that people were known by.
Do you remember anything about Harris? What kind of officer he was?
He was a very flashy gent, a natty dresser. But we hardly ever saw him, you see. He was away back. You know, hardly ever came up. And we only sort of got together, and then he laid on things. He was quite a good organizer when it came to sort of doing training and the administration of it. But as far as being a professional signaler to do anything really for the people who were providing the nitty-gritty of what was going on, he wasn't terribly successful, in my view.
How about the D Company commander? You'd probably see more of him then.
Yes, yes. We were closer to those. Now, this was the Major Duffy, who got a medal, I think, possibly an MC, for leading a bayonet attack at Salerno. A very good officer. Very well respected. Trustworthy. Very bright and capable of planning attacks. And I had a great deal of respect for him and was very pleased to work with him. And we did work together because in the company headquarters would be just the signals and the stretcher bearers and the company sergeant major and a messenger, that sort of thing, a sort of a tight group. And the officer in charge used to talk to us because we were the people who had all the information and, you know, used to chat around. We used to offer him our suggestions of tactics and so forth. And we used to talk tactically to him at times if they felt so disposed. And, you know, it was...
Were you on first name terms or was it still...
Oh, there was still second name terms, really. It was friendly, but, I mean, it wasn't... In that sort of first name situation at all. That never arose at all between officers and other ranks. It does now, of course, in the reunion. Quite funny, that. Some of the oldies can't see beyond. They tend to think of them as sir, you know, and they feel like they ought to salute them even when they're talking to them. But the rest of us are on first name terms at this point in time. No, I think one has to go along with the niceties of the discipline. We didn't, although we do. The point was that in a sort of a war situation, the discipline isn't overstated. People do things because they like you or respect you or whatever, as well as because they have to, but mainly because they like you or whatever. There are very few, and if they were, they didn't get very far. Martinets up front, at this point in time, at least.
Now, up this one, the crossing of Volturno, you hadn't come under a lot of fire, from what you say.
Well, yes. Immediately after we got away, it was fairly well a silent crossing, if I remember rightly. That was the intention, it was going to be silent, and I think someone else was going to make a noisy one, but ultimately came to be known. And we were attacked. You see, the nature of how one attacked, or what happened in the tactics of the thing, was that you would have an objective which you would have to attack by various means, deploying in a company your platoons or whatever. And you would take that objective after a skirmish or a battle, or you might even be repulsed, but on the assumption that you took it. That was the first stage, that was stage one. Then everybody would move forward, including company headquarters and the signals, and you would dig in then. Because the first thing that happened is you'd be counterattacked. Maybe counterattacked immediately, or counterattacked subsequently, but you would be counterattacked. So that you immediately got there and got positions and got your company disposed in a defensive position at that point in time. Everyone dug in, get down, because you would be shelled almost immediately anyway, because what was happening in Italy was that we were always attacking retreating positions. The Germans would have a position, they would retreat from that, they would have fixed lines of guns on that, they would have shell positions for firing of mortars and a firing of 88 guns or whatever, so that almost immediately you were fired upon. So, you know, you got dug in quite quickly.
Were you more nervous? You'd been wounded by mortar fire once. Were you more nervous of shell fire and mortar fire after that experience? Or
no more than I would have been anyway. I think anybody was. So, no, not particularly so. One was just afraid. One was afraid all the time. Fear in these sort of contexts is not just a mental thing, it's a physical thing. You really have almost like indigestion, or someone gnawing at your insides all the time that you're in action because of fear, or even the thought of going to action. This is what you have to live with, and that really is what is the quintessence of bravery. Not doing something remarkable at any one time, but continually having to go in. Because what happens ultimately is this, that everyone's conscious in, say, a company position, that you're continually being pushed into action. People are killed, your friends are killed, and it's a state of attrition. Eventually it will be you that will be killed because of the sheer inevitability of it all. And this is the thing that gets you, and you keep getting pushed forward, seeing people go, having to live with the fear, and then ultimately comes a point where you can't go on anymore.
What was it that kept you going, or how did you keep your... What were the influences there? Was it discipline, fear of court-martial, pride, wanting to be with your friends? What was it that helped you keep going?
There are all sorts of influences. Not bravery, or not even fear of court-martial, really, in a sense. More a fear of loss of self-respect. That... you think that you're a man, that you ought to be able to do this sort of thing, and that you'd be less than a man to yourself if you didn't. You didn't think of king or country or anything like that at that point in time. It was also respect for your mates that were with you. You were supporting one another. You did it for them. You did it perhaps sometimes for a commanding officer with whom you had a high regard. He was doing it. He was there with you, and you were part of it. You were supporting him. Also, which was, I think, one reason why not many officers perhaps were shell-shocked or quite infrequently, was that it was useful to have some responsibility, that if you had responsibility for others, this gave you an extra determination not to let them down or yourself down or whatever. And we as signalers had this responsibility. We had the responsibility of establishing and ensuring communications, and therefore I felt, you know, myself, that this was an obligation that I had to see whatever else happened, and I kept everyone, the two lads, jollied along at times by this virtue that we had to do it. And there's a story later on, I think, which illustrates that.
So now, it's theoretical, but if you'd been in charge when you crossed the canal, you probably wouldn't have led that headlong retreat. You know, you wouldn't have allowed the men to leave the...
No,
If you'd been in charge...
These were early days, of course. I mean, this sort of thing builds up. I mean, that was... Even with some sort of experience, I had only been in action, I would guess, on two or three occasions, even at that point in time. So I hadn't built up much sort. And you've got to have had some experience of it before you're able to arrive to some sort of rationalization of what you're doing and why you're doing it. I don't know. It's very difficult. Later on, I tell a story where I did just do that.
Okay. You crossed the Volturno.
Crossed the Volturno, and we had positions, and there was shelling, and we eventually secured the crossing, and the Germans pulled back, and that was one river. There were counterattacks, as they invariably were, but we managed to hold on. And as I say, the next month or so was really a question of crossing various rivers. We crossed the Tiano, was another one, but that wasn't a boat crossing. That was a fairly smallish river, and we crossed that without any problems. And we had this situation at that particular time, I remember, although Paul, many of the details of it, but there was a particular occasion in the Tiano battle where we were with a platoon, company headquarters, in a farmhouse being attacked quite rigorously by Germans. And on that occasion, that was the first time I did it, I brought down an artillery stonk on the farmhouse.
How would you do that? Would you ring your battalion, radio your battalion and ask them to do it, or could you get...
All of these places had code names. That was the start of it. So you said, you know, and I forgot what there were different levels of what sort of attacks one could bring, and some of them had to be approved further back. All I was doing was asking for permission of the commanding officer, say, for him to ask the artillery who were in contact with him to approve us.
You just got through to your battalion?
Which they would pass it straight on, I guess. I mean, I don't think there was any attempt. But there might be some argument about the level, how many troops of guns they would use or whatever.
What was this target you brought the stonk down on?
It was a farmhouse. And we were all in the farmhouse. And the Germans were getting quite close outside. And the nature of what happened in that, as long as you were undercover, as I say, subsequently you did it at odd times, artillery shells, some are inclined to fall short or overshoot or whatever in the best of stonks, so it's not automatic thing. And as long as you're in somewhere fairly well undercover, keep your heads down, the chances are that you're going to get a ring around there. And anybody that's not undercover is likely to get more of a hammer than you are. And, of course, you used it as a very last resort. And that, in my view, was the first time I used it. And I thought I was the innovator of that, but it transpired I wasn't. Other people had done it.
You were under heavy attack at that time?
Yes, yes. But I only mentioned it because I thought I was the one that sort of discovered it, but I wasn't. It wasn't me at all. Yes. We moved on. The next stage was in sort of December that year, where we were moving away from the rivers. The next big river was the Grigliano, which really starts the casino battle in a sense. That's the run-up to casino battle, because the Grigliano is the river that separates casino in a way from the rest of the front. But we were moving somewhat more inland to a hill called Mount Camino, mountain, which was quite high. I don't know, a couple of thousand feet, might even be more than that, 3,000. And the actual hill itself and its spurs were taken by the 56th Division, I think. Might even mean part of our division, but it wasn't taken by us. But it was our role to capture a spur from this mountain called the Cocoruzzo Spur. And it was the plan of our commanding officer, Colonel Johnny Preston. And it's symptomatic, I think, of the quality of him. He was a great tactician, that he chose to plan to attack down over the mountain onto the flank of the Germans who were holding the other side, and come onto the Cocoruzzo Spur more or less from the rear, in effect. Having said that, we had to go up this mountain in the rain. And it was the beginning, subsequently, they used them more, the beginning of the use of mules for carrying. The rains had come. Italy in the rains was a terrible place to be in. Everywhere there was mud. Transport was bogged down in the mud. You couldn't move around in it. It was cold and it was desperate. And particularly in the mountain areas and subsequently in Casino, they found they had to use mules. And these mules were bloody awful. They had muleteers who looked after them. I don't know whether they were trained or not. But the animals wouldn't necessarily move. They sometimes just stopped and people kicked them and threw bricks at them and the damn things wouldn't move, but they were marvellous in going up these mountain tracks, picked their way beautifully up the mountain tracks when they did decide to move. But I remember that was the first time going up Mount Camino that we had seen mule trains being used to any great extent. Anyway, we started up this mountain and we bivouacked, just went to sleep, I guess, on the near side of it. Next morning we went over the top and debouched onto the plain. And after some hand-to-hand fighting on the part of some companies and other parts of the battalion, they did eventually take the Cocoruzzo Spur. I didn't get involved in it. Somehow or other, I got left behind with the set in a particular spot. I don't know if it was in a hut or in a cave, I think. And why I was left behind was, I was left behind with an officer who I guess was a platoon officer. Might even been a second command of the company. Who was shell-shocked. And I remember me being there, I was what, about 19, really. This poor bloke was crying, uncontrollably crying. Couldn't do anything. He was, I guess, come to the end of his tether, and he was ashamed of himself because he couldn't do anything because he was crying. But there was only he and I there, and I comforted him, and I spent most of the battle just looking after him. They didn't seem to want me at the time. The battle went along, and they did capture the spur. But all in all, it represented a good tactical battle. And I'm not sure whether he didn't get a DSO on that account, but he did get a DSO for some...
Preston,
yeah.
What were your impressions of Preston? You obviously thought...
Preston was a fine guy. He was, I think I mentioned earlier, this question about he was the old aristocracy, the old officer class, true gentleman. But also being a regular with some tactical know-how. We eventually lost him, and the bloke that took over for him again was a gentleman and aristocrat, I suppose. But no tactician, no one with a military brain. But Johnny Preston had a military brain, but very friendly, very open, and he got on well with everybody and talked and chatted to the ordinary soldier. And for many years after the war, he came along to the reunion, and I had lots of chats with him, and he was really an admirable person. And everyone in the battalion now has no word of anything other than praise for Johnny Preston. Anyway, it was really first class.
Who did you think were the key personnel in the battalion, the officers or the NCOs? What were their relative roles?
It was difficult because what happened was that new lieutenants, as they came from, say, England, there were, new one stars floating around, coming in as reinforcements, fresh from England, quite young, without any experience, did go right in the front of the battle, in charge of platoons. So until unless they had learned their trade, they were dependent upon the NCOs. So the people that were carrying them were, of course, the sergeants, the platoon sergeants, essentially. And, of course, the company commander would be more experienced. Now, some of the officers were very good and learned their trade and did very well. Others were not up to it. But the turnover of platoon commanders was incredible. I mean, what would happen almost invariably is if you were at all good as a platoon commander and lasted any time at all, before very long, and they would take you and make you a company commander because, they were so short, really. But quite often they were killed or captured or what have you. Didn't last the course for one reason or another. I wouldn't like to say what the turnover was, but it was quite horrific. But you are, I think, in the end, very much dependent on the quality of your NCOs, the sergeants, the company sergeant majors, the corporals. They're the people with experience who perhaps quite often lasted, being more experienced and veteran trained, were there in continuity to a greater extent than the officers. But the officers did learn their trade ultimately. Or didn't, if they didn't.
What would make a bad officer?
Someone, I guess, who quite obviously didn't have much regard for his men, who wasn't prepared to be up with them. I mean, if you think now about this fellow Jones in the Falkland War, went out in front and led his troops and was chopped down. Now, that was quite foolish. No one really expects that. But if you're in a tough spot and your officer has told you what you are to do, you expect him to be in the near vicinity. You don't have to be looking behind you for some miles to see whether he's there or not. So he has to be part and parcel of what's going on. It'd be foolish to be leading you. It wasn't that sort of battle anymore. Although there were occasions where someone would say, "Follow me, lads," and they did follow him because perhaps the situation demanded that. But it was more likely you saying, "I want you to do this and that and the other, and I should be following up with you." And they had to have some regard, I think, for the feelings of the people that they were asking to do the jobs that they were. And they certainly participated in the sort of life that they had.
It didn't have any better conditions
to speak of, no. Except things changed if you got back to sort of semi-permanent situations. The officers would get together, and the sergeants would get together, and you'd be back to the class formation again. But up in the front, it was very largely a non-class type situation.